From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Despite President Bush's demand for an end to the Israeli invasion of the West Bank, rockets still rip the sky and tanks still thunder through Ramallah, Nablus, and Jenin, the strain between Bush and Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has steadily grown from diplomatic disagreement on Thursday to open defiance today, when Sharon declared to the Knesset that Israeli military would not stop the offensive until its mission is complete. That is, until the terrorist infrastructure, as he calls it, is destroyed. American and Israeli leadership no longer see eye to eye. This hour, old allies stare at each other across a cold new gap. We begin in Washington, where the Bush administration is reacting to Ariel Sharon's refusal to immediately withdraw Israeli troops from the West Bank. Earlier, I spoke with Ann Kornblut, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. I asked her how President Bush is responding to Prime Minister Sharon's defiance.
Not well, I would say. This is the kind of defiance that President Bush does not appreciate. He's appearing very testy, as anyone who's heard or seen him in the last couple of days would notice. And it's left him in a very awkward position. He is now in a position of not being able to actually do anything except keep demanding that Sharon comply. I mean, his statements today are, "I meant what I said." Well, he sounds like a disappointed parent, but there's not much he can do.
What are the implications if President Bush is angry? What does it mean for the relationship for U.S. policy for the Powell mission?
What it most likely means is that Powell will need to go deliver the message even more strongly than Bush already has. It probably won't mean much in practical terms. The expectation coming out of Israel is that by the time Powell actually gets there, there will be some signs of withdrawal, if not complete withdrawal, by then. But it makes it all that much trickier. He's issued a demand and it hasn't been complied with, and at this point, he looks ineffective, to say the least, and his credibility is on the line. So for President Bush and for Powell's trip, it's important that there be some movement that we haven't seen yet.
And if the Israelis don't respond until late in the week when Colin Powell is scheduled to arrive in Israel, hasn't President Bush lost any advantage he might have had in the eyes of the rest of the world in securing a pullback?
Hard to say. A week is not a very long time in the scope of history. It will remain to be seen how important this particular week becomes. I don't think it's a sign that Israel and the United States are no longer on the same page. The Israeli public expects us to be on the same page. And how it's viewed by the rest of the world, I think, would remain to be seen.
And do you have a sense of the reaction in Washington beyond the White House to Sharon's stance?
I'd say it's divided, like it is throughout the country. There are people who don't think President Bush should have made this demand in the first place, who think that Israel should be able to defend itself against terrorism. And there are people who feel that Sharon has been the problem all along and that Bush should have made this demand a long, long time ago. So I would say it's divided.
Is the White House making any statements today to try and save face in the face of this Israeli defiance?
They have said that they've gotten assurances that something will take place. Powell has said that. President Bush has not spoken to Sharon since he made his angry phone call on Saturday. I would expect that if something doesn't happen, we'll see another phone call. But they are, for the most part, reiterating their determination to see something happen and at the same time trying to focus a little bit on their domestic agenda.
Ariel Sharon said that Israeli troops will eventually pull back to what he called buffer zones. President Bush has said they should pull out. I'm not sure exactly what the difference is. Could it be that the withdrawal, when it comes, will still not be enough to satisfy Bush?
I think it's hard to say. The first statements that Bush made were vague. He said pull out. He didn't say when. He didn't say to where exactly. In some ways, it's given them a lot of wiggle room to save face. I don't think we know at this point. I think they would be glad to simply see some movement in the direction of out right now. And what the ultimate shape it takes would be negotiated later.
Ann Kornblut, do you have the sense that the Bush administration, the inner circle, was surprised by Ariel Sharon's open refusal to comply to President Bush's demand?
I would think so. I don't know for sure, but there's only been one occasion since the two leaders came into office around the same time when they had an open disagreement, and that was last summer. It didn't go on for very long. So I think they're surprised to see it not only occur, but also now carry on for 3 or 4 days.
And, of course, the Israelis may indeed pull back by the time Colin Powell arrives later this week, but Europe and the Middle East region has been watching this minute by minute, hour by hour. Is Washington concerned that it's lost credibility with third-party observers of this conflict?
I think the White House, it traditionally has had a fair amount of confidence in its standing. You know, we've seen protests in Europe before over the environmental policy that didn't force them to change anything. They feel very confident that we should be able to act independently and not, you know, test the winds of Europe every time we do something. That said, they're going over in response to some of these protests, in part. And I don't think anyone expected Powell, for example, to hear the harsh words he heard today in Morocco, where he was asked, why didn't you go to Jerusalem first? So I think at this point it's a balancing act.
And the president's temper in all this, we saw he was flashing angry over the weekend and again today. Is his Texas dander up?
I think so. He does not like being defied. We've seen it on a number of occasions, especially as reporters. And so, yes, I would say it's very fair to say that he's angry.
Ann Kornblut is a Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. The tension between America and Israel tonight is tight and troubling. On Thursday, President Bush said enough is enough. He called on the Palestinian Authority to stop terrorism and for the Israeli military to withdraw from the West Bank. Prime Minister Sharon replied by welcoming Secretary Powell's visit to the region, but ignoring Bush's specific call for withdrawal. On Saturday, Bush picked up the phone and called Sharon, telling him that the military offensive had to stop now. In response, Sharon accelerated the Israeli push into the West Bank. Today, defiant action became defiant words when Sharon told the Israeli Knesset the drive would go on. President Bush responded that he meant what he said. Israeli troops must withdraw without delay. Late in the day, Israeli radio and it said Israeli troops would withdraw from two northern West Bank towns, but the day's tone was defiant. We cannot accept going back to the situation as it was before the operation began, Mr. Sharon said on state radio. Israel is at the point of no return. Are the United States and Israel on a fast track to failed diplomacy? Are the national interests of these old allies diverging? How much weight does an American president's word carry in the Middle East today? Should American support of Israel give Washington a say in the deployment of Israeli tanks and troops? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio is Steve Van Evra. He's a political science professor at MIT and a specialist in Middle East defense policy. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Van Evra.
Hello.
Good to have you. And with us from the studio of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Jack.
Stephen Van Evra, it's been quite a handful of days here, one like we've not seen in some time between Washington and Israel. Ariel Sharon has been very blunt, the latest in saying, we'll do this our way, thank you, Washington, even when President Bush was really putting the pressure on. Late today, Israel Radio says that Israeli troops were preparing for a staggered withdrawal from Qalqilia and Tukaram. Those are relatively small towns in the northern West Bank. And it's not as though this means withdrawal or an end to the incursion, invasion, call it what you will. There was still fierce fighting, a lot of tank movement and rocketry and gunfire today in Jenin and elsewhere. Take us to the nub of this. What's going on here? What is it that leads an Israeli prime minister to say to the president of the United States, no?
I think there's four issues now between the U.S. and Sharon. And I like to talk about a conflict between the U.S. and Sharon, not the U.S. and Israel, because Israel's very divided over policy, and a lot of Israelis also doubt what Sharon is up to. But there are four big issues. One is the tactics of dealing with terror right now, whether the Israelis ought to mount this incursion or not. Is the incursion a positive or negative thing to do? And the U.S. view is that it's negative because of its public relations backlash and also because if you destroy the Palestinian Authority, then you have no one in the end to make a truce with. And Sharon, on the other hand, thinks you have to root the terror out. But there are three other issues that deserve ventilation, which are deeper and also mark a sharp difference between Sharon and the Bush administration. One is larger security goals in the Middle East. The U.S. is focused on the war against al-Qaeda. We have a very, very serious threat to face from al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda is out there tonight trying to figure out ways to get weapons of mass destruction to the United States and set them off. Israel's much less worried about al-Qaeda because Israel's not being attacked by al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's attacked the U.S. something like 9-10 times since 1993, depends how you count, 4 successes. They haven't been going after Israel. And I think also Israel's a lot less vulnerable to that kind of terror because they've buttoned down their borders better than we have. So they're not as worried about al-Qaeda, and so they're not playing ball with our war in al-Qaeda.
So there's a second item on your agenda. It's al-Qaeda, and behind that, weapons of mass destruction and vulnerability there, too.
Yeah, we have a big fish to fry, and the Israelis are basically not as worried about it.
We're going to come back and talk about that. What else is on your list tonight?
I would say also other strategy issues. Bush is worried about Iraq. The Israelis are not as worried about Iraq. Bush wants to attack Saddam. The Israelis are very ambivalent about that. They're much more worried about Iran.
Iran supports terrorists
in
their view.
Iran supports terrorists in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And Iran is backing Hezbollah and the PA. They're backing all the terrorists. Third issue is the settlements and the whole Israeli policy of settling the West Bank. Sharon is devoted to this policy. He's the godfather of the Israeli settlement movement. He's the guy who designed the Israeli plan for settling the West Bank and Gaza in the 70s. He's overseen the development of the whole settlement project, which now has 400,000 settlers living in the West Bank and Gaza. And the U.S. has at different times objected to this. And when you scratch beneath the surface, all U.S. policymakers understand that these settlements are a huge obstacle to the only peace that people can imagine, which is a trade of land for peace.
But yet you don't hear them talked about much, not at the upfront part of this conversation with Israel.
Yeah, we haven't been raising the issue much. We have in the past. I mean, Bush's own father, Bush Sr. Bush the father once made this a major question and held up the $10 billion loan guarantee in 1991, and that actually led to Shamir lost the election over the issue.
Stephen Everett, we're going to come back and march through these, but let's go first just to the simple dynamic here. How common is it for an Israeli prime minister to say no to an American president, and how significant is it for it to happen at this time?
Well, you know, we've had 7 or 8 major tiffs in U.S.-Israeli history. They've all been sorted out one way or the other. The biggest ones would be in 1956 when Israel seized the Sinai in conjunction with Britain and France, and Eisenhower went bananas, didn't like it, and basically forced Israel to withdraw from the Sinai. There was the issue in 1991 when George Bush insisted that Israel agree to halt settlements as part of getting the peace process going, and Shamir, then the prime minister, said he wouldn't, and so Bush held up the loan guarantee. There was major friction over Camp David 1 between Jimmy Carter and Begin. Prime Minister Begin, Carter wanted Israel to put the West Bank on the table, and Prime Minister Begin essentially refused to do it in the end. There was a lot of friction over the Lebanon invasion in 82, which, again, Sharon was the guy who – that was his project. He cooked it up. He organized it. He led it. And after Secretary of State Al Haig okayed it, then the Reagan administration changed their mind and decided that it had gone too far and there was a lot of friction over ending it.
And when these gaps open up, what exactly is the U.S. leverage? You don't openly hear Washington saying, hey, we give you $3 billion a year and it's going to start to vanish if you don't fall in line. How does the leverage work?
Well, in 56, the U.S. did put all the chips on the table. We threatened Israel with oil. You know, oil cut off and non-cooperation, economic sanctions. We threatened the British and French too. And in 91, we threatened, as I said, the $10 billion loan guarantee. But usually it's done in a much more civil fashion. Yeah.
Jack Beatty, you can see this is not the kind of conversation President George W. Bush enjoys. He's getting pretty shirty the last couple of days.
Yeah, as we heard from Ann Kornblatt, he doesn't like being defied. I'm interested in pressing Steve on something, on the question of whether our interests are coinciding here. I mean, the Israeli public can say today, look, we've just had 5 or 6 days without a single terror bombing. And the reason looks to us to be because we are in the face of the terrorists on the West Bank. And sure, the U.S. doesn't like it, but it has other fish to fry, al-Qaeda, Iraq. Our security is secure so long as our army is down the throats of our enemies. What do we say to them when that seems to be true, or at least they've had this period of peace?
Steve, let's hold that question. We're going to come right back after a break. We're just heading into a break. We're talking tonight about Israeli defiance of George W. Bush's demand that Israeli troops come out of the West Bank. There's going to be a small pullback tomorrow from 2 towns in the northern West Bank, but throughout the rest of the region, the incursion goes on. It goes on fierce. What do you think? When the U.S. president says jump, should Israel say how high? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the standoff between Washington and Israel, slightly bridged late today when Israel Radio reported that Israeli troops will begin withdrawing from two towns in the northern West Bank tomorrow. But most of the Israeli action continues to go on, despite very strong words from President George Bush and Secretary of State Colin Powell today. The question is, how serious is Ariel Sharon's rebuff of George W. Bush? When the U.S. president says jump, should Israel say how high? And fundamentally, are the strategic interests of the United States and Israel diverging here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in the studio tonight by Stephen Van Evra. He's a specialist in Middle East defense policy and political science professor at MIT. He's author of Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. Steve, just before the break, Jack Beatty was asking, hey, we've had 5 days here without a civilian bombing of civilian populations in Israel, though there have been suicide bombings, we read, against Israeli forces in the West Bank. Should Washington be looking at this and saying, well, maybe Sharon's right, this is the way to stop Israel's problem?
Well, I have a minority view on this matter. Will the incursions succeed? I think that if we let the incursions run for 6 weeks, as the Israelis wanted to, I think they might well succeed in basically quieting the terror to a very low level for a pretty long time. History shows that counterinsurgency waged in urban areas, which aren't vegetated, always succeeds. It's very hard to maintain any kind of rebellion against a determined occupying power if you're fighting from cities and from places that don't have a lot of woods to hide in.
Of course, we've seen the Battle of Algiers, and that didn't turn out so well for the French.
Well, the French actually won the Battle of Algiers.
Okay.
They lost the war.
They lost the war.
They lost the war, and that was going to be my second point, which is if the Israelis do reoccupy essentially the West Bank, quiet things down, and they're going to have to do a lot of brutal things, very brutal things to do that. But imagine they do it. This is not the end of the game. And I think this is the big sort of fallacy that Sharon is operating under. He thinks that that's the last move. And I think that at that point, there'll be another move. The game will go on. Mm-hmm. And my real fear is that at that point, you're going to have the unleashing of some kind of nihilistic terror on the Palestinian side that we haven't seen yet.
We'll talk about where that might take Israel, where these two visions take Israel. But you've laid out several important distinctions here potentially between Israeli interests and U.S. interests. Secretary Powell said today in Morocco that the ongoing military presence in the West Bank was having a significant and severe impact on the U.S. efforts. More broadly, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the national security advisor to President Carter, wrote over the weekend that the current crisis poses a grave threat to United States interests. You've said that this incursion gets in the way of the U.S. battle against al-Qaeda, that it makes the U.S. vulnerable to weapons of mass destruction, more vulnerable through al-Qaeda's reach, that it cuts George Bush off from his desired attack on Iraq, and that it leaves obviously unsettled the whole question of Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Do we have a fundamental divergence of interests here between the United States and Israel? Is this bridgeable? Where do we stand?
Well, I think we do have a fundamental difference with Sharon, okay? And as I said, half of Israel doesn't agree with him either.
But we're told that the most likely successor to Sharon is Benjamin Netanyahu, even more hardline.
That's true. And in the sort of heated atmosphere of the terror bombings, he's going to be the successor if there is one. But a large minority of Israelis would basically accept peace on essentially 1967 lines, as long as they were assured that those lines were secure, which I believe we can assure them of, and as long as they were sure that there would be no continuation of the violence, no more terror, I think a majority of Israelis would actually support peace in those lines, under those terms.
Those are pretty large assurances, and we're not sure, sitting here tonight, who can make them, but we do know that whether it's Israel or not, it's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who is currently the leader of Israel. Stephen Van Evra, stand by. We're joined now by Gideon Rose. He's managing editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Gideon Rose. Gideon Rose, are you there? Calling for Gideon Rose in New York. Jack Beatty, it sounds like he's not there right now. Jack, are you there?
I'm here.
Good. You hear Steve Van Evere saying we've got some fundamental strategic divergence of interests here between Ariel Sharon and the United States right now. It's an awkward moment for that gap to open up, isn't it?
It really is. And, you know, several times since the foundation of Israel, our interests have been seriously damaged by our alliance with that country, which is an important alliance and one we want to maintain. But, you know, the Arab oil embargo of 1973 imparted an inflationary spiral to our economy that really caused unemployment, all manner of economic and social ruction right up into the 1980s. And now, of course, our alliance may well cost us something even graver, as Steve says. I mean, we have to, in some way, to defeat the long-run threat of terrorism, get right with the Arab world without abandoning Israel. But it does seem to me that gives us a kind of urgent edge to say to the Israelis, look, this is about us now as much as it's about you, and there's something grave at stake, our security. And as a result, we're willing to step up. And I think that is what Stephen was implying. Step up meaning saying we would commit troops to essentially separate these peoples and to police and guarantee a peace along 1967, pre-67 borders, which Abba Iban once called Auschwitz borders.
Hmm. And yet we know that even within the Bush administration, there are those who are all for Ariel Sharon's hardline approach. It's a complicated scene. I think we have Gideon Rose now. Gideon Rose, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Gideon Rose, you were on the National Security Council 94-95. You're at Foreign Affairs Magazine now. You're watching this along with all the rest of us, this split that's opened up between Ariel Sharon and George Bush over the last several days. How serious is it?
I don't see it as being all that serious right now, partly because there are splits within the Bush administration as well, and clearly there's a strong faction that backs Sharon and is telling the president not to pressure him much. So as long as the prime minister thinks that he's got friends inside and who will make everything okay, you're not seeing a great crisis.
Zbigniew Brzezinski writes in the New York Times, and our guest Stephen Van Evere in studio tonight says that we are looking here at potentially, we're looking at a crisis that poses a grave threat to the United States' interests, and that the U.S. and Ariel Sharon may not end up on the same side in addressing that, that there's a gap here that could be very detrimental to long-term U.S. interests.
I think that's true. The basic fact here is that no one really has a good answer for what's going on. Most Israelis would be happy or at least willing to give up the territories if they thought there was a partner on the other side who would take them and not shoot at them from there. But the tragedy of what's happened over the last 2 years is that first in the negotiations from Camp David onward, when the Palestinians never responded to Barak's offer, and second, when they turned to violence yet again, the Israelis now feel that there is nobody on the other side. They have no partner for peace, as they said. And so they really don't know what to do. It's not that they want to keep the West Bank, although a minority of them would like to keep the occupation going permanently, but they really don't know what to do with it. And quite frankly, no one in the administration in the United States knows what to do with it either.
Of course, that goes back to talking about Israelis. Stephen Van Evere has been careful in making a distinction between some amorphous public opinion there and Ariel Sharon's opinion, which has often been analyzed as being this, that he doesn't really want a peace process to resume, that he'd never liked the Oslo Accords, that he doesn't want a two-state solution with Israel, that he'd prefer a one-state solution. Your view?
Well, this is the great problem in what he's doing, which is I don't know for certain whether that's true or not, but he certainly is allowing others to think it's true, and particularly he's certainly allowed the Palestinians and the Arabs to think that he doesn't really want peace. In the same way, quite frankly, that Arafat's temporizing and going along with the violence has made it quite plausible for the vast majority of Israelis to think that he's not interested in peace.
Steve Van Evere, if Ariel Sharon really isn't interested in a two-state solution, and maybe he has no leader on the opposite side who's interested either, where does that leave the United States?
Well, if that were the case, we'd be in real trouble. I think what we have to do is jawbone with the Israelis about the peace terms they're willing to offer. This is the fourth issue that I was going to mention that lies between the U.S. and Israel. Sharon's peace terms are much more ungenerous than those that Barak offered. He's been basically saying, I'll offer 42% of the West Bank, whereas Barak offered 91%.
A deal that will never be bought.
Okay, and then Barak upped the deal to 96. Yeah, there's no way that any Palestinian leader would ever contemplate anything close to 42%. So what he's really offering is an untakeable deal.
So in that sense, the rift that opened up in the last couple of days over this incursion is really a small window on a much larger rift.
Yes, absolutely. Israel, the Sharon government has to come up with different peace terms, and the American government should be saying, listen, you know, what you're talking is a non-starter here. Let's see real talk about something close to the 67 lines, because there's nothing else that's going to work.
But let's be real. When Powell sits down, I mean, so far, George W., with all his very public jawboning, hasn't even been able to get Sharon to agree to the pullout he's demanding. And much less a fundamental shift on what he's willing to offer the Palestinians. Is the U.S. a toothless tiger here? Gideon Rose, let me come to you on that.
Well, I mean, I think the what Steve said is absolutely true. And at some point, the United States is going to have to basically deliver the message to the Sharon government or any successor that the ultimate deal is going to have to be even more painful for them than the Barak's offer was, which at the time was the furthest any government had ever gone and was deeply unpopular in Israel for that reason. But, and here's where I really am pessimistic, the problem isn't just on the Israeli side. It's not just a question of pressuring Israel to make them give up more concessions, because even if you were to have the Barak offer on the table right now, the Palestinians rejected it without even coming up with an alternative at the time it was first put out there almost 2 years ago. And there's no reason to believe that Palestinian expectations or hopes have come down in the time since then. So the problem really does lie on both sides, and nobody really has a good answer. And so the immediate set of tasks for Powell and the administration is to calm things down, but it is not at all clear that once we get over that little hill, we won't realize the true size of the mountain that's lying in the background.
Steve Van Everett, Gideon Rose, stand by. I want to turn to our callers. Here's the question. If George Bush calls a peace party and nobody comes, what are the consequences? Eric is on the line. Welcome, Eric. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hey, I wanted to say you guys have a great show. Since September 11th, it's in its previous incarnation, has been good.
Thanks, Eric.
I really just want to say how disappointed I am in Bush. I mean, he announced last Thursday that Colin Powell was going to be sent off to the Middle East to talk to these guys. And Sunday they say, oh, well, he's leaving and he will be there sometime around Thursday. And I think Bush is really just stalling. He's trying to, you know, he doesn't want to take a stand. He really doesn't want to make any decisions on this.
Eric, do you think he's still stalling when he gets on the phone on Saturday to harangue Ariel Sharon, when he goes public today saying, I meant what I said?
But what's behind that? I mean, what's he going to do if Sharon doesn't do anything? And he's, you know, the more time Sharon gets, the more time they have to do whatever they want over there.
And there's plenty going on every day. Eric, it's a great question. Let me put it first to Steve Van Evra. I guess two things. First, is there a chance, as many people said last Thursday, that this was pantomime on Bush's part, that he was demanding something but didn't put initially down a time frame for his Israeli withdrawal, and that even now this is a kind of public drama behind which the U.S. is happy to see Israel going ahead with its drive in the West Bank? Or is it as serious as it looks? And if it is, and in spite of calling and demanding in public, they're not getting really the response they want, what does that mean about U.S.-Israeli relations?
Well, I think he is serious about any of the incursions. The tone he took today was a very firm tone, and if the Israelis carry out their program, which is basically 6 weeks, okay, and they're in about how many days into it?
Ten days?
Okay. A lot of time left to run, and he's not going to sit still for the next, you know, 4.5 weeks. So he is serious about any of the incursions. What disturbs me is that I don't think he's given Powell enough poker chips to play while he's over there. Apparently, Powell is still under instructions to be cagey about talking to Arafat and to try to continue finding a sort of quisling Palestinian leadership to talk to, and that's not going to work. Apparently, I see no sign that he's given Powell the authority to discuss any specific peace concepts. And in the end, I think the only way to break through and make a truce here, get a truce agreement, is to show both sides where it's going to end up.
Gideon Rose, let me put it to you. Eric says President Bush is being wishy-washy. Do you think so? And following on that, how is this rebuff from Israel going to play into the larger American interests in the region?
I haven't been a huge fan of the president's policy towards the region up until the past week. I was one of those who felt that the statement on Thursday and what he's done since then has been a welcome intervention, because clearly we've seen that letting the region live by itself is a path to even further conflict.
And if it doesn't have teeth?
Well, but see, here's the thing, and this is the part that people really should understand. One of the reasons I haven't been so critical of the administration, however, is that the problem they're facing is incredibly difficult. The Israelis and the Palestinians are not prepared, particularly the Palestinians, to make the kinds of concessions that are necessary for a true and lasting peace. And the question then becomes, what can the United States do if it wants peace more than the local parties? And the fact is there's some kinds of leverage that the president can bring to bear on both sides, but it's very costly. And it's also, you don't want to make threats, because if you make threats, then you're forced to carry them out. And they're very costly if you actually have to go to them.
Give us an example of the kind of leverage that might be brought to bear on Ariel Sharon.
Well, you could begin talking about aid. You could begin talking about arms sales.
Can you imagine the U.S. would really withdraw aid at this high tension moment? Would they really hold back on arms sales?
No, absolutely not. But, you know, the president's father did something in which he basically said, you're going to have to use aid for certain kinds of things and not for the settlements that we think are unhelpful. So you could basically realize that aid is fungible, mm-hmm. and therefore say, as long as you do X, Y, and Z, you don't get extra funds. I don't think that's going to happen. But the same way with Arafat, which is the president basically could delegitimize Arafat 100% and say, we are not going to deal with him. He's a terrorist. He's in the Osama bin Laden category.
Open him up to assassination?
Well, it's not so much to open up to assassination as just simply basically make him a non-player. But once you do that, you can't go back, because you look a complete fool if you've done that. So the administration has been very, very reluctant to do what its some of its hardline supporters want, which is to call Arafat a terrorist, because the fact is, A, he is a terrorist, but he's also the Palestinians' chosen leader. And so if you want to play in the region at this point, you have to deal with Arafat.
Jack Beatty, do you feel the bite of U.S. leverage in the wings here? Do you think Washington's going to come down on either party with these heavy measures?
I don't know, but I do think that was a significant statement of the president's and a significant turn in his policy. I mean, I didn't understand the policy all through last year. It basically seemed a kind of peevish reaction to what Clinton had tried to do and had nearly brought off. And occasionally the political unconscious of the administration emerges in offhand comments from Ari Fleischer or from President himself about, well, it was Clinton, by pressing the Israelis, who brought on this whole rebellion. That seemed to have been their mindset. And that was, of course, at variance with reality. And it was doing nothing to stop what was happening in the Middle East. But you almost feel that Bush became interested in it and engaged only because he saw that this was a roadblock to Iraq, that he wasn't interested in the thing in its own terms, and he didn't realize that this is a bigger threat, or as big a threat to U.S. national security as Iraq. So maybe that turn last week will spread that idea of the relative threats in the Middle East.
The relative threats, and there sure are a lot of them, and tonight even this tension with the old ally, Israel. When George Bush cracks his whip over the Middle East, is anybody listening? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the standoff between President George Bush and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon over Israel's military action in the West Bank. Our guest tonight, Stephen Van Evra, specialist in Middle East defense policy at MIT, and Gideon Rose, managing editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, say there are deep underlying rifts here. What do you think? How serious is Ariel Sharon's rebuff of George W. Bush? And are the strategic interests of the United States and Israel diverging? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, Jack.
Hi.
Stephen and Gideon. I don't know. You've covered so much ground. I don't know how much I can add, but I just wanted to briefly touch on looking at this perspective from the point of the U.S. Middle East policy of reaction versus action.
Okay.
The fact is I think Jack was saying just before the break, this administration has been living in Clinton's shadow. Their fear of failure, hands off, waffling on the fence, backpedaling. And I think what went on is that Bush was shocked into action. There was a sudden turnaround by him in rhetoric. He became assertive and forceful and demanding of Israel as well as the PLO, but I don't think he would have been as demanding of Israel if there hadn't been behind-the-scenes moderate Islam governments threatening to uproot their former relationship with the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And on a solipsistic basis, the U.S. was afraid and even heard the threat of a further oil embargo above and beyond Iraq's today.
And, of course, that's going on today. Well, let's go straight to that, Paul, and thanks for your call. Steve Van Evera, what about, is it Arab world reaction that's driving Bush here? Are they calculating the costs day by day of this Israeli incursion going on, being broadcast all over the Middle East, its cost in terms of Arab enmity? Or is it a more dollars and cents, hard-nosed calculation of costs here?
I think it's 80% what Paul says, that Bush has large fish to fry in the Arab and Muslim worlds, and this conflict has become – it's obviously now a huge impediment to U.S. policy. Putting this war on TV throughout the Arab world every night is inflaming the Arab street, inflaming it.
Bush is saying stop it now, and Powell is not going to arrive until Thursday or Friday. What is the cost, Gideon Rose, do you think, of the daily dose of Arab world, watching this thing continue to go on in flames?
I don't think we're going to see an immediate explosion in the next few days, either in the various Arab countries or in U.S.-Israeli relations, because I think there's going to be enough of a pullback for the Bush administration and the Sharon administration to basically claim that they're on the same page, at least for the next week or two. The question will then become, when you get, as we've been talking about, to the substantive questions and differences after that, what happens? And I think that one of the points about this that might make the president so annoyed is that he's starting to realize just how complicated this all is, and that you can't put everything in simple categories, and that some of the advisors, perhaps, who have been trying to assure him that everything Clinton did was wrong, and that if he only sort of takes a tough line and walks away, everything will be okay, he's now realizing that that's just unfortunately not true, and that the Clinton administration wasn't just a bunch of bumbling, naive incompetence, but they were honest people trying to do a very tough job.
Mm-hmm. Badoui's on the line. Welcome, Badoui. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
We're well, thanks.
Actually, I would like to just add some points here. When we are talking about the credibility of the U.S. in general, we have to know also, we don't want to rely on, we need to know the history of this prime minister of Israel, Sharon. He was not interested in peace, and he is saying this is openly. And if we look to his history in Lebanon, he misled the U.S. administration at the time, and he invaded Lebanon. And it's documented that at the time, as the administration saying, he was not supposed to go that far. If we are stand in defiance with him, if he's standing with defiance with the president right
yes.
now,
mm-hmm.
is that what we already put Israel in? Because if we look to the Israel, it's already stand in defiance for more than 69 United Nations Security Council resolution. And there is no other country in the world, whether a member or not a member, has been frequently condemned by the United Nations.
But I think we got your basic point. I want to put it to Steve Van Evera, and let's take it to this issue of the West Bank. There's been speculation, you tell me if it's more than that, that Ariel Sharon A, doesn't want a two-state solution. B, wouldn't be entirely sorry if a lot of Palestinians decamped to Jordan. Is that too extreme a view of what he'd like to see transpire?
Well, first let me just say, I think Badawi's right that Sharon has a long record of being very stiff-backed in dealing with the United States. He walks right next to the line. In the late 80s, every time Secretary of State Baker went over to the Mideast to try to start talks, Sharon would greet him with new settlements. Take this, exactly. In 1998, after the Y Accords were signed with Clinton, Sharon permitted them to be signed. He sort of allowed Netanyahu to sign them. He immediately encouraged all the settlers to go grab the nearest hilltop.
But now he's on a roll, and how far might this be pushed?
Well, you're asking what's his long-term goal? And his long-term goal is occupation and settlement of the West Bank. He's long been a devotee of the concept that all of all of Palestine west of the Jordan ought to be Israeli.
So this is a much larger defiance in the sense the Bush administration has been perhaps the most forthright U.S. administration in saying we support a Palestinian state.
Correct. It's the first time the U.S. has supported a U.N. resolution saying that. And so Sharon's long-term dream of control of the West Bank collides completely with that. And we have to have some kind of coming to terms with this. We've got to ventilate this.
What's going to force that coming to terms? Gideon Rose, can you see anything that brings this down to a real head-to-head where it's resolved?
Yes, but unfortunately it's not going to happen, because the one thing that could actually bring those tensions to the fore would be some offer or significant movement on the Arab side that would actually accept the kind of moderate deal that the United States would like to see.
And the Saudi Arabian initiative doesn't qualify?
In its current version, absolutely not. It doesn't talk about a number of things. It actually regresses from some of the aspects of the Clinton
right
plan
of return.
And so forth. Well, the Sharon is many of the things you're saying, and he is also the democratically elected leader, a wildly popular leader of a country that turned to him when its negotiations fell apart and a war was launched against it once more. And so the fact is there is nobody more responsible than Ariel Sharon's leading the Israeli government for Ariel Sharon's leading the government than Yasser Arafat. And that's the real problem. The Israeli people kicked Barak out and went to Sharon and may kick Sharon out and go to Netanyahu precisely because they don't see any payback for the concessions that Barak made.
I want to put that to Steve Van Evra. What about that? The Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat, tough negotiating partners. Many people say that they sort of threw the whole Barak effort into disarray at the end. Do you think that some other Palestinian leader would have accepted what Barak offered? And B, do you think the Palestinian Authority might be open to peace now? Or is it all tough spine on that side as well?
Well, let me say, I have a somewhat more optimistic view of the Palestinian Authority's bottom line for peace than Gideon does. My bottom line is I'm not sure what it is. He's correct that the PA did not respond to Barak's offer at Camp David 2. But they finally did respond in considerable detail during the winter after the Clinton plan was put forward. Bill Clinton put a plan forward. And
was Arafat reckless not to go along with Barak's plan?
Well, if you look at the plan, you know, everyone has to decide what their bottom line was. And it was a much less generous plan than it's been portrayed in the U.S. press. You often hear that it was 95 or 97% of the West Bank. It was actually 91%. That was the offer.
Does that make a difference, those 3, 4%?
Yes, because if you look at the land that Israel was going to keep, it would subdivide the West Bank into three non-contiguous entities. And it also was going to subdivide Palestinian East Jerusalem into several non-contiguous spots, which meant that Palestinians were going to spend their lives going through checkpoints.
So you're saying that a reasonable Palestinian might not have accepted that plan?
Yes.
No, I agree entirely. And in fact, very few people thought that the plan was going to be accepted right away. What you can hold Arafat guilty of is not just rejecting the plan. It's not responding with anything of his own and then allowing and encouraging the return to violence. And I think that Israelis are at least as legitimate in thinking that they don't know what Arafat's intentions are as Palestinians are in thinking they don't know the same about Sharon.
Well, I agree.
Everybody's in the dark here and afraid in the dark.
And everybody assumes that the worst-case scenario is what is really driving the leader of the enemy.
I agree with Gideon. I think the biggest question about the Palestinians is what they mean by right of return. I think the territorial limits are quite clear. And let me say, my understanding of the Palestinian bottom line, if you listen to what they've said, is they have to have a deal that they can sell to their people as essentially return to the 67
borders.
Yes. They're willing to let the Israelis keep 3% of the West Bank.
But that's the right of return means what about Palestinians who still have claims on land inside Israel?
Correct. That's an explosive issue, and they have never used numbers suggesting how many people they demand should have a right to return. They've used language. The language has had a reassuring element to it. They have said that they are willing to separate the recognition of the right from the exercise of it, implying that once you say we have the right to return, we won't demand to return.
Or they could be compensated. There could be some other settlement. I want to turn to the phones. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, my question is, there's been a lot of discussion about this is against U.S. interests because we're, quote unquote, fomenting the Arab world. But why should we in any way be swayed at this time or at any time by what they think our interest is not to appease terrorism. And if we tell Sharon to back off, we're sending the same message that we sent in Somalia, the same message that Europe sent to Hitler in World War II. You can't appease these people.
And there are a lot of people in Washington saying exactly what you're saying there, David. How about it, Gideon Rose? How about this notion that Sharon is right, that you've got to just lay down a hard line, and that's that, right across not only Israel and the West Bank, but right across the Arab world?
I would say yes, but it's true that there are certain kinds of attacks and certain kind of methods that you simply cannot accept. On the other hand, there are a variety of different interests the United States has here, and that's the great tragedy here and the great complexity for the Bush administration is that you can't take any one angle of this and privilege it above the others. The reason the United States has been so interested for decades in the peace process is because it's the way that was seemed out there to square its otherwise competing interests in terms of stability in the Arab world and oil, the flow of oil from the Gulf, and assuring the security of Israel. As long as Arab-Israeli relations seem to be getting better, those two fundamental interests in the Middle East weren't in conflict. And that's why the United States has kept coming back to try to generate some kind of peace process.
But isn't there's a third issue now. And David, thank you for your call. Speaking of terror, Stephen Van Evere, you said right at the top that the U.S. has an even bigger fish in this fry, bigger stakes here. That is the threat of weapons of mass destruction, the threat of another al-Qaeda attack on the United States.
Yes, I think al-Qaeda, we have to keep our eye on the ball. Al-Qaeda is the fundamental threat to American interests in the world today, not just in the Middle East. And they pose a very serious threat. This is the most serious threat we've seen in decades.
And how big a problem or an opportunity in that context is this U.S. tussle with Israel?
Well, we depend completely on to defeat al-Qaeda on intelligence help from the Muslim world and Arab world states. We have to have it. We let our CIA capabilities in the Muslim world lapse for many years, didn't keep news specialists up to date in the local language and so on. And a counterterror war is essentially a war of intelligence. The victory will go to us only if we can find these people. Beating them is easy. The problem is finding them.
What's the connection between that and the fight we're talking about between George and Ariel Sharon?
We've got to have cooperation from the Arab intelligence agencies. We need help from Jordan. We need help from Sudan. We need help from Egypt. Okay?
You're saying the tussle with Israel or the Israel campaign in the West Bank is shutting down that cooperation?
Let's just say it threatens to? It threatens to poison it.
And the cost of that?
Catastrophic. I mean, then we can't defeat al-Qaeda. We also need help from these countries shutting the door, making sure that the al-Qaeda elite have no new place to run and hide and set up new camps. And to the degree that we alienate Arab regimes, we loosen their willingness to shut the door.
Our time's running down. Stephen Van Evere, I want to thank you for being on with us, and it's been great to have you. And Gideon Rose in New York, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Gideon Rose is managing editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. Stephen Van Evere is political science professor at MIT. Jack Beatty, you hear the lay of the land being described here. This is not just a disagreement of a couple of days here that's being played out with Israel. There are some serious stakes behind this matter of days.
Yes, and September 11th puts a kind of punctuation on it that's never been there before in our relations with Israel. And I think that is what the president finally has understood. And he's understood it when he sees these demonstrations in the Arab world. And there were even some mention in the Times of fear of an embassy seizure in one of these countries, a la Iran in 1979. And he sees it in the rising oil prices. So and in what Steve was talking about, diminishing intelligence assets.
But there must be some tough meetings in the White House because he has advisors who agree with Ariel Sharon. Let's stay tough.
Yes, and you can read them in the Wall Street Journal every day.
Every day. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can read excerpts from Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's speech today in the Knesset on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.